All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Okay, dismiss the band, folks. Here it is, Bob Gould back once again for another edition of Veterans Radio, coming to you live from the Garden Spot of the Midwest, the Garden Spot of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Michigan, from Talk Radio 1600 WAAM. Those of you that are listening live, and that's right, that's live, you know, we're going on our, coming up to our 13th year, 13 years all live programs, folks. That's a lot of programs. And that's a lot of live broadcasting. But we're here today, once again, and we're bringing you one of our frequent contributors, Kevin Hemel, who is, he's just written a ton of stuff on my, one of my favorite topics, and that's General George S. Patton. Not just because he was an Army general, but just what he was as a person and as a man. He'll be right with us in just a moment, but we've always got a few things to take care of right now. So, okay, what's happening today? The Vietnam Veterans of America Picnic, that's Post 423, is hosting a picnic for Washtenaw County Vietnam veterans and families and anybody else that wants to attend. You know, that's a problem. Sometimes, well, this is a veterans picnic. No, it's for everybody. It's going to be at the VFW Post 423 at 3230 South Wagner Road, Ann Arbor. That's coming up on the 2nd. Of August, that's right, so that's next week. And it starts at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Bring the, what does Neil Diamond say, pack up the babies and grab the old ladies and all the veterans and come on out. Oh, it's a great location. And they roast a pig, a couple of pigs, as a matter of fact. So RSVP, you can go to Dogman2@ Reagan.com. Boy, he's letting it hang out there, isn't he? Vance, you're really something. Dogman2@Reagan.com. Okay. And, what happened to Derek? We lost Derek. Oh, he says the stretch. Well, we're going to be right back. This is Bob Gould from Veterans Radio, right here at 1600 Talk Radio WAAM. Don't go away.
Safe and hardworking over-the-road truck drivers deserve modern and well-maintained equipment they can count on. Conway Truckload has purchased over 500 new Kenworth T680s with twin-screw axle drives, automated manual transmission, and other features that improve handling and comfort. Take a virtual tour of the equipment on truetoblue.com/equipment. Speak to a recruiter and apply to drive for Conway Truckload by calling 866-WORK-FOR-US. That's 866, the word work, the number 4, and the U.S.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
There we go. Yankee Doodle Dandy. I thought that was kind of appropriate because I can't think of anybody that epitomizes truly an American spirit, the American warrior spirit. He truly was a Yankee Doodle Dandy. But before we get to that, here's our guest today, Kevin Hemel. Kevin Hemel is Director of Research for Sovereign Media. That publishes World War II history and World War II history. They're quarterly magazines. He also writes articles for both of them. So he is the director of research. Oh boy, we're going to have lots of questions for him on Mr. Patton. He is also a former historian for the U.S. Combat Studies Institute. Oh, we're going to want to ask him about that. He also conducts historical tours. He's part of the Stephen Ambrose historical tours, and he leads annual, we got to ask about this too, in the footsteps of Patton tour across Europe. Right now, let's give a big welcome to Kevin Hemel. Kevin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Bob, how you doing? Great to be here. How you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's the weather in Washington, Hot?
90 degrees and sunny.
Ooh, okay. Ooh, well, I wonder what George would think about all that. But before we, you have spent so many years of your life, 20-plus years, researching General Patton. And if there's anything that we're going to leave out today, I can't think about what it's going to be. So I'm going to start with an email I received from Portland, Oregon, and I sent a copy to you, Kevin. And this is from a gentleman who was an artilleryman, one of the Reglegs over in Vietnam, and he's a regular listener and a regular contributor as far as emails. And by the way, if you have something you want to comment on, you can email us at Bob or Dale at veteransradio.net, either one, veteransradio.net. So he writes, he says that he has a patent quote that I keep near my computer. Here's the quote. Here we go. "It is foolish and wrong to mourn the men who died. Rather, we should thank God that such men lived." Take it from there, Kevin.
Well, that is a direct patent quote. That's something he said when the war in Europe had ended, and he returned back to the United States, and he was basically on a war bonds tour. He was speaking in Boston, and he actually got in trouble for saying that, because so many relatives of soldiers who had been killed in Europe felt that Patton was being callous, where he was really celebrating those who, you know, had fought well and hard. And, you know, he really held a high standard, a real high bar. You know, just being in uniform to him didn't make you a hero. You had to go out and prove yourself on the battlefield every day. And so the men respected those kind of standards. They knew that he would be pushing behind them through the entire length of the war, and it motivated them, whether positively or negatively, it motivated them. And, you know, I think, and I'm glad that people today are still finding inspiration in his words, that this gentleman, you know, probably reads this every day. And I've often seen, especially in the military, having worked for the Army, you know, getting emails, and underneath an officer or an enlisted man's name, they'll put a quote from General Patton. And so it's very inspiring to know that his words today still hold a lot of truth to people in uniform and who have worn the uniform.
You know, and that's something that I think that I want to point out right now, that General Patton has survived 70 years of revisionist history, and so many others that had shining armor, etc., have fallen by the wayside because of such scrutiny. And yet General Patton continues on. He continues on in a shining light. Tell us some more about that, Kevin.
Sure. You know, there's always going to be people questioning historical figures, trying to poke some holes in them, for both ill and good. And, you know, Patton's reputation, I think, has sustained, I think, for two reasons. One, the mistakes he made were all out in the open and were addressed immediately when they happened. And then two, you know, the sort of the secret behind his brilliance was his hard work ethic. You know, he got up every morning before sunrise and visited the front before his staff meetings so that his staff really had to know what was going on, because he could question them. He spent his free time, you know, Eisenhower spent his free time reading Western novels. Omar Bradley spent his free time doing math problems. Patton spent his free time reading military history. He was completely ensconced in it, and he was always trying to improve. I think the perfect example of this would be the second half of the Sicilian campaign, while General Montgomery is struggling across, you know, southern Sicily to push north. Patton simply skips around the enemy three times with amphibious assaults. And what I found in my research was that when he reached Palermo, before he even reached Palermo, he was planning the idea of amphibious assaults, and he told the Navy, "I want to land an entire regiment behind enemy lines." And the Navy kind of balked and didn't give him enough ships, so he was only able to do battalions. So even though it wasn't as strong an attack as he wanted, he was thinking off the map. He was thinking creatively. You know, I've read through his diary several times, constantly, you know, bombarding Bradley in Europe with ideas of dropping small units of paratroopers behind the lines to secure bridges. You know, just a constant, consummate professional who's always thinking, how can I do this better? How can I trick the enemy, and how can I win with the least amount of casualties?
And he was an honorable man. Eisenhower had his Kay Summersby. Bradley had Mrs. Bradley. I guess what. But so many of the great men have been feet of clay. But there is George Patton. He still is as strong, and he doesn't have to have a square jaw or a brush cut. He was all there, and he don't you feel that he was living history? I think he wanted to be remembered in history, but he wanted to set the tone. And in your book on Patton's photographs, here's something else, folks. Next time you see a Patton photograph, check around his neck. He's probably got a Nikon, Kevin?
No, it was a Leica camera. It's actually a German-made camera, but they were made in different parts of Europe and the United States. Yeah, he wore a Leica camera around his neck with black and white, and it actually had his gold initials on the back, GFT. And he carried this thing from North Africa into the heart of Germany, snapping whatever took his interest. And, you know, that's such a gold mine for an historian, because we're constantly trying to get inside the heads of our subjects. And here Patton is saying, hey, look, this is exactly what I saw. You know, and in the photo albums that I found at the Library of Congress, he would actually write, on the back of the photographs, what he was looking at, why he was looking at it, and then his wife would transcribe that information below the photograph in the photo album. So this was a whole new cache of information on Patton's inner thoughts that had not been scratched before, because everybody usually goes to the diaries and the letters. So this was a whole new angle of examining Patton. And, you know, I'd always tell people there's nothing controversial about this. It just adds another layer to our understanding of General Patton.
He was taking selfies before selfies became popular.
That's right.
and folks, next time you see the video on the History Channel or whatever, and look carefully, you'll see that camera, which I find that fascinating. And he, because he wanted you to, he, well, he wanted in the future to historians to look at and see it through his eyes. But I believe too that reincarnation had a lot to play in all this. Tell us about Patton's feeling and future lives and past lives.
Well, he definitely believed that he had lived at least seven previous lives, all his soldiers. And if you see the movie Patton, he recites somewhat of a poem that he had written called Through the Glass and Darkly. And the actual poem itself lists each life that he lived and what he did in that life. And this is, Martin Blumenson theorized that, you know, as he got older, maybe he started putting himself into the history he was reading. Well, he was doing this as a child. He reenacted a battle with his friends, and when his mother got mad because they rolled a wagon down a hill and broke a fence where a bunch of ducks were being kept, and they all went into the yard. And she said, what were you doing? He goes, well, I was reenacting William the Bald, you know, when he made this attack. And she said, how did you know about that? He goes, oh, I was there. One of my favorite stories is that when he was entering Germany in the last days of the war, they were him and his staff entered the city of Ratisbonne, or Regensburg, as it was called at the time. And he turned to his assistant, Codman, and he goes, you know, I remember coming through here and crossing the Danube here.
Wow.
And there was this big rock, and Napoleon was standing on that rock urging us all forward into Russia. And Codman, you know, just thinking, God, the old man's a nutcase. I can't believe he's talking about this. And the next day, Codman wandered down to the Danube River, and there was a huge rock.
Oh, no. Well, we're not going to take sides on that either way, but it definitely was driving the man. And you know, I really want to put to rest all the things about abusing troops and that. Why don't you just take about a minute or so and just briefly touch on that?
Well, he definitely believed in corporal punishment. He was accosting troops from the first day of the war. He talks about kicking a lieutenant in the butt, and actually it was a Navy sailor who was on the shore. He kicked him in the butt. And even grabbed a lieutenant by the lapels and shook him. and the Navy seaman actually got on a boat and went back to his ship and bragged to everybody that he had been kicked in the butt by General Patton. It kind of almost became a badge of honor with a lot of troops. There was an incident where he saw a group of soldiers marching in the desert, and one of them was wearing a British jacket, a British Army jacket. And so Patton stopped his vehicle, went over to the soldier, ordered him to take it off, said, you know, give me your jacket. Patton took it and then slapped him in the face a bunch of times with the jacket, threw it back at him, ordered him to get a shovel and bury it, which he did. And when that was all over, Patton turned to his lieutenant and said, I'm coming back tomorrow, and if everybody is not wearing American uniforms, I'm fining you $20. And took off. And one of his aides said, you know, General, weren't you a little harsh? And he laughed, and he said, yeah, but they'll never make that mistake again. And that was the real sort of essence of Patton's almost draconian discipline. You know, you kind of almost scare them out of their boots to make them remember things. And you got to remember, this is a civilian army. These are citizen soldiers. You know, to make up such a huge army for World War II, we had to pull a lot of people out of their civilian lives and put them in uniform, and they didn't know the first thing about attacking on the offensive and cover fire. And so Patton would rather have the soldiers hate him with his harsh discipline than lose those men in combat because they didn't know what they were doing. Now, it did go over the top at times. You know, he slapped two soldiers in the hospital in Sicily, and he really had just lost his temper. And I've heard from both sides about this. There were some soldiers in a tent nearby, and a nurse ran in and said, General Patton just slapped a soldier, and they all cheered when they saw him coming out to his car. And this one officer said, you know, we felt like we were off on this foreign battlefield and nobody in the United States cared, and General Patton slapping that soldier was like slapping all of America and saying, hey, there's a war on and we need to take it seriously. On the other side, I talked to a medic from the 101st Airborne who was actually working in Walter Reed at the time, and he said when he learned about it, he said he just became disgusted with Patton because he knew that if a soldier's in a hospital, there's got to be something wrong, and that Patton didn't care. But, you know, he was pushing his army to Messina, taking casualties, having a very difficult time, and actually a general named Huebner blamed himself for it because he said that Patton visited him. And General Huebner, you know, Patton said, you know, how are things going? And Huebner said, well, we got a lot of gold bricks. We have a lot of guys not doing their job and trying to hide behind the lines. And he said, you know, I feel like I planted that seed so that when Patton went into the hospital and saw all this grievously wounded soldiers, that when he came to a soldier suffering from, you know, as the soldier said, nerves, but, you know, it was really post-traumatic stress, Patton just lost his temper. But, you know, that reputation for draconian discipline stayed with him through the whole war. And people shaped up when he entered a room, when he was in the field. There was actually a reporter at the end of the war said that he drove across, you know, France north to south and visited different army groups. And he said it was only Third Army, Patton's army, that there was a sense of urgency. And I think that was the great payoff of his harsh draconian discipline. I'm going to tell you one more quick story. I can't put this in a book because this was told to me and I couldn't get a cite. But one time when I was in Europe, I talked to a curator of the American cemetery in Brittany, and I told him I'm leading a Patton tour, and I said, can you tell me anything? He said, oh, we had a vet come back one time, and he had fought in North Africa, and he said he was sitting in a foxhole, you know, hadn't eaten in days, hadn't shaved, exhausted, and here comes Patton in his, you know, perfectly, you know, ironed uniform, and just starts yelling at him and says, the enemy is out there. You need to be facing him. You need to be vigilant. You need to shave, get your uniform together. You're a disgrace. And Patton Turner walked away. The guy said he shouldered the rifle and got Patton in the crosshairs, but then he thought better of it. And he said it took him about 20 years to realize that Patton did the exact right thing, because he said he was so exhausted that if the enemy had come up, he would have surrendered immediately. And Patton made him so angry that if the enemy came up after Patton's visit, he was going to shoot anything that came.
You know,
so, I mean, it got the result that Patton desired and that an army needs.
That's right. And we're not just talking about anecdotal things, folks. This was an edge the man had with him at all times. And I don't mean edge that he was tense. Oh, maybe probably that was part of it. But it was part of that character. And we've only got how many minutes, Nina? Oh, we got a few. Okay. That in the movie, and I love the movie. By the way, George C. Scott went to the same high school I went to in Detroit, Michigan. So, hey, how about that, eh? And, oh, he's a great actor. They couldn't have picked anybody better. And in the movie, he talks to Carl Malden, who was Bradley, and he said, I hope they don't lose their fear of me. Tell us about that.
That is exactly right, that, you know, he did not believe officers should be friendly with the officers below them or with the enlisted men. You're there to do a job, and, you know, I want you facing the enemy and firing your weapon instead of running away from him. And if you know that I'm back here with ivory-handled pistols on my hips, you're gonna stay facing that enemy. And, you know, I know veterans that said, you know, thank God I wasn't in Third Army. Patton would get you killed. You know, I know other soldiers said, yeah, we never stood still in Third Army because Patton was always on the move. And it's that, you know, fear of Patton that, you know, the old man's going to come down on us that kept soldiers acting professionally, moving forward. And he really delivered the idea that, you know, the faster we win this war, the more lives we save. And so if Patton had to drive his head through a wall to discipline his troops, he was going to do it. There was nothing he wouldn't do to get that war over with faster, because he knew that was the real key to saving lives. As harsh and as brutal as the fighting in the Battle of the Bulge was, you know, he performed it so skillfully and saved lives in the long run.
I had a little experience with the same thing, maybe on a little smaller scale as far as rank, but our captain, when I first got into the airborne, Captain Potterstadt, I think I can say that now. Man, he was born with a scowl on his face. He had a scowl. And you just did it, man. You did everything. You made sure your shoes were shined, everything was put and squared away, and you just didn't want to get on the other end of that scowl. And I could see a lot of that. That's right. And that's the way a commander is supposed to be. They're not to be your, hey, let's all have beer and steaks. No. You have to maintain that separation. So he was not, as Bradley was, a soldier's general, right? Isn't that what?
No, he was a general's general. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that about the scowl. Patton actually used to practice scowling in the mirror.
Did he?
When he was a cadet at both the Virginia Military Institute and at West Point. And I just was actually up at the Army War College in Pennsylvania, and I was reading a memoir of a soldier, a general in the Pacific that knew Patton from VMI, and he said that Patton, what did he say? He said that Patton had a high, squeaky voice, and the upperclassmen would make fun of him for it. And this general said, I think that's what drove him to be such a serious, you know, leader, was the humiliation of being laughed at for his high, squeaky voice. And so he forever kept that scowl and worked on his voice, and, you know, he really had an image of what a leader should be and lived his life for that image.
We have about 3 minutes for the halfway point. How you doing, Kevin? You all right?
I'm doing great.
Oh,
man.
Good.
How you doing, Bob?
Oh, yeah. By the way, I'm with Kevin Hemel, author, historian. You see him on the History Channel. You see him on the Military Channel. You see him all over the place. He wrote 2 books. Patton's Photographs, War as He Saw It. Folks, if you want a coffee table book, yeah, man, I'm looking for something. Well, and you can go ahead and get Patton's Photographs by Kevin Hemel. I'm going to spell that. H-Y-M-E-L. That's The War as Patton Saw It. Or it's number 2 book. Patton, legendary World War II commander. So anyway, but, you know, maintaining, I guess I want to get to this one part in the movie that I look forward to seeing is when he first comes, I think it was Tunisia, right after the battle where they were, the British and the Americans were shoved away. And he walks in to the barracks, and in about 1 minute, he just wakes everybody up. Tell us a little bit about that scene.
Oh, sure. You know, he basically does an inspection of the entire Second Corps area. Now, this is after the Battle of Kasserine Pass, where the American 1st Armored had taken a real bloody nose, and the 1st Infantry Division had gotten a hit too, but had actually performed pretty well. But the entire command needed rebuilding. There was no real solid leadership in Patton's predecessor. And the only way Patton could really get 2nd Corps to stand up on its feet was to visit every unit that he could to be, you know, to get with the soldiers and find out the details of what was wrong. And in that scene, he kind of walks into the barracks, and the men are kind of feeling slothy, and, you know, he knocks down a picture of a pretty girl.
Oh, I love that. I love that part. This is not a bordello. Oh.
Exactly. You know, and those are the kind of things.
Can I interject something?
He began fining soldiers for wearing the wool cap, for not wearing ties. And what he did, because the soldiers started to pick up on this, and so what he would do, because he would have MPs walk down the streets, and anybody, you know, without a tie on or without a helmet over their wool cap was going to get fined. And so when the soldiers saw the MPs coming down the streets, they would duck into huts or tents. And so what Patton did is he started taking doctors who were off duty and had them walk down the streets in front of the MPs, and the soldiers wouldn't do anything when they saw the doctors. And then they'd see the MP and straighten up, and the doctor would say, no, this guy and this guy were both, you know, without ties. And so Patton really took it to a high level to get the discipline back. And now on the positive side, too, while he's increasing discipline through fines and through constantly visiting the frontline troops and addressing them individually, he did improve the food and the mail. And so, you know, those are two things vital to the doughboy out there, to the foot slogger.
Okay.
You know, as long as he can get good food and hear from his family, that's going to do great things for his motivation.
Well,
and so Patton said, you know, along with the one hand of discipline, I've got to have that other hand of treating these soldiers well and motivating them, you know, on a personal level, and that's exactly what he did.
Okay, well, that's the band. They woke up. We'll be back in just about 2 minutes. Stay with us, Kevin, have a break. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Don't go away.
Safe and hardworking over-the-road truck drivers deserve modern and well-maintained equipment they can count on. Conway Truckload has purchased over 500 new Kenworth T680s with twin-screw axle drives, automated manual transmission, and other features that improve handling and comfort. Take a virtual tour of the equipment on truetoblue.com/equipment. Speak to a recruiter and apply to drive for Conway Truckload by calling 866-WORK4US. That's 866, the word work, the number 4, and the U.S.
Hi, I'm Gary Sinise. There are thousands of veterans still living on the streets of our nation. Please support Veterans Matter. Your donation can help house a veteran in minutes and prevent another from losing their home. Donate at veteransmatter.org or text VETS to 41444 to make a donation of any amount. Let's all help Veterans Matter take care of our own. Thank you.
Yeah, the Andrews Sisters. I thought you'd all like that a little bit from World War II as we're talking with Kevin Hemel, our historian, and General George S. Patton. I did want to interject one thing, folks. And when Patton knocked that picture down, you know, there's a lot of, well, you know, in the Army, that no, we didn't have any of that in our outfit. Boy, you didn't have anything like that in your locker anywhere. Not that there was any moralistic, but just like Patton, he felt you're here to train and keep your mind on what your work is, right, Kevin?
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, so it was. It's not like, well, there were pinups all over. No, not really. Well, maybe in the Navy there might. Oh no, we're going to get a lot of emails because of that. But anyway, Kevin Hemel, who is our historian, author, wrote the books Patton's Photographs, War as He Saw It. Patton, legendary World War II commander. What do you think was the essence of his genius, Kevin?
He did the work. You know, he did not deny any good idea. He was constantly on the battlefield examining the enemy and trying to think how to beat them. I had mentioned before about how he did those amphibious end runs in Sicily. Well, in France, when he basically broke down the doors of the German army and raced across France, across the German 7th Army's left flank, you know, General Eddy, one of his corps commanders, said, you know, how far do you want me to go? He says, 100 miles. And Eddy went pale. And Patton said, go do it. And Eddy called him a couple hours later and said, oh, my God, we've gone 100 miles. What do you want me to do now? He goes, go another 100. I mean, that was the essence of Patton right there. And, you know, all the other generals would say, you're going to expose your flank if you go rushing across to the enemy. They're going to be able to cut you off at the waist. And what he did that no general had ever done before, he assigned flank protection to his 19th Tactical Air Force. He gave airplanes the job of protecting his army's flank, and that's exactly what they did. They attacked anything mobile heading towards his army from either side and really neutralized any threat of the Germans. It's because he knew that the farther behind the enemy you could get, the more confusion you're going to sow, and you're going to prevent him from reacting to what you're doing because he's so busy defending against what you're doing to him. And so I think those, you know, those are two perfect examples. The third, of course, is what he did at the Battle of the Bulge, that he took his army that was pointing east and turned it north when no one else thought it was possible in just terrible weather conditions. And really drove his 4th Armored and 80th Infantry Division incredibly hard until they broke through to Bastogne on the day after Christmas.
But he was also there. He wasn't in the, that command thing, you know what I'm talking about, looks like a circus box there, staying warm and toasting his toasties. He was out there guiding these guys, right? And he was
leading the charge, man. There's pictures in my book of him, he took the photograph of an observation post, which is, you know, basically a big trench with guys with binoculars. And he was so close to the battle that he could hear the different rates of fire of the German and American machine guns. How close is that? You know, one time on the Moselle River, he went into a house that was serving as an observation point, and he actually walked down a road to it when the colonel advised that he walk through an apple orchard so the enemy wouldn't see him. And he goes, no, I'm not afraid of the enemy. And so he walked down this road into the observation point, and, man, it came under some serious machine gun fire, and Patton got out through the apple orchard. But, you know, what a perfect illustration of a frontline general. You know, he's there in the mud. He's there under fire. There are constant stories that he relates in his diary about driving through artillery barrages to get to the front. In North Africa, he led the troops at least 4 times. And to tell you how specific this is, he had a tank rolling behind him that hit a mine. And his driver finally begged him to turn around. But he walked through minefields to lead his troops in North Africa.
Now, do you think he could have been general of the army?
You mean Eisenhower's position or Bradley's?
Yes. Well, Bradley's, maybe not, because Eisenhower was the administrator. He knew supply, right? Right.
Eisenhower was a brilliant man and did an incredibly hard job that I don't think Patton had the diplomatic skills for. But as an army group leader, yes, I think he would have done a bang-up job. Of course, that's easy to say in retrospect. But, you know, there were times where he said, I'm glad I'm not the Army Group Commander because it doesn't give me enough independence to you know, maneuver as much as I'd like to. But, yeah, I do believe that if he had gone up one more level, the war would have been over a little quicker.
Whoa.
Yep. In fact, I talked to a number of soldiers who fought under him. There was an attempt that he made to rescue his son-in-law from a POW camp.
Yep.
And I talked to the officer in charge of the rescue attempt and said, you know, did you ever think of, you know, complaining that, you know, Patton had done this and risked your lives? He said, no, Kevin, I honestly believe that General Patton was able to get the war to end at least 6 months earlier than it would have. And I wasn't about to, you know, cause any waves on that. So that was a pretty ringing endorsement of his general right there, I thought.
What did he think about the Battle of... Now, I mean, we know the Battle of the Bulge, and we knew he came to the rescue, and he did what he had to do. But what did he... did he foresee something like the Battle of the Bulge, perhaps in the Ardennes? Tell us about that.
You know, I have to say this. He really did, because there's a quote in his diary that everybody uses. In late November, he talks about how the First Army, Courtney Hodges' army, is kind of sitting on their butts and not being active, where he kept Third Army just inching forward, even if, you know, he just would not let it stop from September to December. As much as it was inching one day or a couple of miles the next day, he kept it moving forward and kept the Germans off balance. Now, about 10 days before the Battle of the Bulge, he wrote in his diary, now he was planning a big offensive, and he had three divisions in reserve, and they were going to be the punch-through force. And he wrote in his diary about this, and he said, however, if the Germans attack up north, parentheses, which is probable, I will be able to, you know, turn north and take care of it. I mean, this is before the Germans have launched it, that he has got this sixth sense that something is going down, and he's going to be ready to attack. And ironically, the German army commander for the 7th Army felt the same thing. He said, you know, you're going to send me, you know, west to protect the southern flank of our big attack. Patton's going to really counterattack fast if we do this, and I need more armor. So not only is Patton predicting this, but the Germans are predicting that he's going to be able to predict it and smash into them. They respected his genius.
Now, he wasn't always an armor man, and he was cavalry. Is that why we see him in the chaps so often?
That's exactly why. That is a great identifier for the cavalry. You know, there's absolutely no reason for an army commander or anyone in a 20th century army to be wearing chaps, but that was his sort of tribute to hearkening back to the old days of the army.
And the riding crop.
That's right. He went everywhere with the riding crop. In fact, you know, the famous story of him shooting those donkeys on a bridge in Sicily.
Yes.
I was reading in his diary to his wife. He said, don't believe that crazy story. All I did was break my riding crop over the guy's head.
You know, I could just see, though, how these stories just spread and spread and spread, and how throughout his whole command that everybody responded to that, and that is the true design of a leader. Were there people in Washington jealous that maybe he would come back and perhaps run for president or something along that line?
Nothing that I've ever seen. He got into a lot of trouble for talking about the future of England and Russia and the United States at a place called Knutsford in England, several congressmen denounced him, and not for leaving Russia out of the speech, but for even speaking about foreign policy as a general. Generals are supposed to stick with military things. But nothing that I have seen was anyone ever worried about, and he didn't want to do it. His father ran for office twice when he was young, and he really had a distaste for serving in government because he said, you know, you have to move, which of course he had to do a lot in the army. But it had a bad effect on him as a child, the idea that his dad was going to not be around as much because he was going to be a politician. His father was never elected. He ran. But it caused a distaste. And I think all he wanted to do was, you know, serve out his time in the military and retire. He constantly accused Eisenhower of being bitten by the presidential bug. But no, he never expressed any desires for political office, nor have I ever heard anything from the world around him.
We're coming up to our third break, but before we do, we're going to talk about, and you're going to give us this info, on Montgomery, General Montgomery, and what he felt about that, and the race to cross the Rhine. Go ahead, Kevin.
Okay, well, he started off with a healthy respect for General Montgomery, but in North Africa, Montgomery held sort of a seminar to talk about what had happened in his campaign, and only Patton and Beadle Smith attended, and you're not allowed to smoke around Montgomery, and Patton pulled out a cigarette, and Beadle, you know, told him not to smoke it. And a British general later said, you know, what did you think of the fact that you couldn't smoke? And Patton said, well, I might be, you know, old and bald, but I'm no dummy. Like, I wouldn't have lit up. And somehow that story got turned around that someone said, hey, what did you think of Montgomery's speech? And he said, oh, I might be old and stupid, but it didn't mean anything. And Montgomery was offended by this, and it was a complete miscommunication. They actually worked well together planning the invasion of Sicily, but Montgomery told him, he said, listen, as soon as we land, I'm doing my own thing. I don't care what our bosses say. And so Patton basically did the same thing. He modeled his attacks off of Montgomery of like, you know what, I'm going to do what I think is necessary on the ground. But Montgomery did start to get under his skin at that point. He saw a lot of favoritism and sort of looking down at Patton. And so by the time he gets to England, it becomes kind of full-blown. In fact, Patton goes and has his own uniform. He gets a new uniform in London, you know, tailor-fit, and puts on all his ribbons because he said he loved wearing ribbons around Montgomery because Montgomery hated that. And so he loved to just, like, tweak him whenever he could. In fact, at one point during the race across France when things slowed down, Patton actually sent Montgomery a gallon of gasoline and said, you know, even though my troops really need this desperately, you know, I figured I'd send it to you because that's all you need in a day with the progress you make.
Whoa, he really did that?
And it's by the
time the battle unfolds that
he has nothing but disgust for Montgomery. He thinks he's too defensive-minded, doesn't understand armor tactics, and is a waste of everyone's time. And every time Eisenhower gives Montgomery a nod to do something, it just makes Patton angrier and angrier. So,
okay. Well, what about
started off with respect for him and thought nothing but contempt by the end of the war.
Well, what about crossing the Rhine? Tell us that little story.
Sure. Well, the design, the Allied plan was for Montgomery to cross the Rhine. He had the industrial areas in his army group area, and he had this elaborate plan, airborne, you know, tons of ships, this big force to cross. And, of course, actually the first people to cross were the soldiers of the 1st Army, the 9th Armored Division, because they capture that bridge in Remagen. And but Patton's not going to be outdone by Montgomery. So he, the 5th Infantry Division, his 5th Infantry Division, gets to the Rhine River, and one of the soldiers told me, usually, you know, we get to a river, we wait for a while, they bring up the boats, you know, he said, we got there, and there were the boats. And so we didn't even hesitate. And so the 5th Infantry crosses, I think it was March 22nd, and they did it at night. And so by the next morning, you know, he had a substantially at least two regiments on the other side of the Rhine River. And he places a call to Bradley, and he says, I don't know if we should say anything, but I'm across the Rhine River before Montgomery. And this is a huge sort of last hurrah, because once they cross the Rhine, the war starts kind of petering out. But he beat Montgomery by 24 hours, and the Secretary of War, Stimson, actually sends Patton a letter. And it says, you know, we gave Montgomery paratroops, soldiers, and even the Navy, and by God, Patton crossed the Rhine. And so that was a headline maker back in the States that, you know, Patton on a shoestring accomplished something that, you know, was taking Montgomery forever to organize and put across.
We'll be right back with our third break. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk 1600 WAAM.
Hi, I'm Gary Sinise. There are thousands of veterans still living on the streets of our nation. Please support Veterans Matter. Your donation can help house a veteran in minutes and prevent another from losing their home. Donate at veteransmatter.org or text VETS to 41444 to make a donation of any amount. Let's all help Veterans Matter take care of our own. Thank you.
The Andrews sisters, sure. That was everybody's sweethearts there during World War II. Okay, we're back with Kevin Hemel and talking about General George S. Patton. We've only got about 10 minutes, right, folks? So let's talk about your tours.
Yeah. Well,
I want to know about the one about Patton's battlefields. Give us a couple.
Sure. I've been working as a tour guide for Ambrose Tours for about 11 years now. And
why don't you give us a website, Kevin? Give us real quick. What's that, Ambrose?
Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours.com.
Got it.
And I basically, you know, talked to the boss about, I said, would you think if I designed a patent tour, people would go? And he said, sure. So we designed this tour that starts in Paris, and we actually go for 2 days and explore the Normandy beaches. And then from there, we head west to the Cherbourg Peninsula. We go to a little town called Nihoux, and this is where Patton had his first headquarters while he waited for enough of Third Army to get into the line. He gets over to France, I think it was July 6th, exactly 1 month after D-Day, and basically his army doesn't become active until August 1st. So there's a tank there and the apple orchard that was there and some stones with Patton quotes and historical information. So we go there. Then we head south. We follow the routes of the 6th and the 4th Armored Divisions as they break out of a town called Avranches and follow their path.
Operation Cobra.
Well, this is the result of Operation, yes, this is the result of Operation Cobra, because they bombed a line about, I'd say about 5 miles north of there. And there's a statue of Patton in Avranches. They highly respect him. There's a lot of pizzerias and other stores that have his name on them. We go into the Brittany Peninsula, where Patton kind of breaks his army into three and goes off in three different directions. And we spend the night at a place called Mont-Saint-Michel, which is a beautiful cathedral out in the water that becomes an island at night. But then we turn east and begin following Patton's army as they work their way around the German flank. We go to Mortagne, where the Germans counterattack. And I've done a lot of research on this, and I take them to the battlefield, and there's still some foxholes there. From there, we go to a town called Mayenne, which had three bridges crossing the main river through the center of the city. The Germans had blown two and were preparing to blow the last. And if they could do that, then it would really stall Patton. And one of his worst divisions had reshaped itself, the 90th Infantry, and fought for this bridge. From there, we continue the encirclement that the Third Army is going to make for the Falaise pocket, and where it gets closed off in Chambois. And there's actually a castle there that was created by William the Conqueror, and the Americans used it as a prison pen for the Germans. And up a little further north, there's a great museum where the pocket is closed, and everybody enjoys themselves there. From there, we actually go up to Reims, where Eisenhower accepted the surrender of the Germans. We visit that area. Then we go to Verdun, where Patton had that famous meeting with Eisenhower and Bradley during the Battle of the Bulge on December 19th and said, you know, I can do this. I can get to Bastogne. And it took me about 5 years, but I finally found the building where it took place. It's
wow.
Actually on a Belgian barrack post. From there, we head south to the Battles of Saint-Mihiel. This is a World War I battlefield where Patton, leading his tanks for the first time ever in the American Army, bumps into a brigadier general named Douglas MacArthur, and they have a talk on this hill while an artillery barrage goes over, and everyone ducks except those two. They're standing there talking to each other, so we stand in that spot.
Oh, I'd love to have had a shot of that.
You got to come. I'd love to have you along.
You know, folks, just think of how many times do you do this tour?
I do it once every summer.
Okay, so it's once a year, and you've just completed it, right?
Okay. In fact, I'm going to be heading back in a few days to lead a D-Day tour. Patton is my baby.
Well, you know, folks, Christmas is not that far off. And you can really, folks, you can go ahead and schedule this stuff and make that a belated or a first-come tour, or I should say Christmas present. And you have somebody, folks, who's going to be with you and tell you everything. You can put your smartphone in your pocket. Got it? You don't need an app. You got the app. It's Kevin Hemel. He's there. He's going to be riding right along with you. Wow. What a deal. How many days is that?
It's about 11 days.
Whoa. And you get to see the countryside, right?
Yeah.
France, Germany.
Belgium, Luxembourg.
Oh, beautiful.
We actually go to the spot where Patton had his car accident, too.
Okay. We've got a few minutes. You know, we didn't talk about, I don't like to talk about that, about him. About him dying, but all right, we got a few minutes. Some say it was not an accident, it was murder. Some say that the truck driver was drunk. Is that true, yes or no?
I believe that the correct thing is the driver had a little bit of a hangover. because he was coming from a party the night before. It was an accident. It really was. I've looked into all the different conspiracy theories, and there have been a number over the years. They started in the early 1970s, and the theory was that Eisenhower had Patton killed because he had discovered all this gold in the German mines, which was true, and that Patton wanted to return it individually to everyone in the occupied countries, and Eisenhower said no, so he had Patton knocked off. That was a theory put forth by French communists in the 1970s. And then a guy, I believe his name was Don Wilson, put together a book called Target Patton, which said that the OSS, the forerunner of the CIA, had done this. But a lot of his facts didn't add up. I actually helped him in some of his research. And what I found, you know, he would say things like, you know, the documents are missing in the National Archives. Well, I've been doing research in the archives for 20 years. There's lots of documents missing. It's not a big conspiracy. He says that, you know, the VIN number on Patton's car at the Patton Museum at Fort Knox is not the same VIN number of the car he had the accident with, and obviously there's a conspiracy there. I actually called the curator and said, you know, what's going on here? And he said, we told the guy that when any vehicle is in an accident in the military, we chop off the bad part and attach a new one. And that's something that the military does with tanks, trucks, vehicles of all kinds. And they said, we told him that, but he chose not to use it in the book. But I think conspiracy theories are a lot of fun for people. It plays to a lot of anxieties and fears and, you know, suspicions. But in my study of it, you know, there was a general sitting right next to him in that car accident. And he just, you know, Hap Gay said, it was a car accident. That's all it was, 35 miles an hour. You know, this idea that there was a sniper that shot him in the neck, you know, there's really no place for it. Like I said, we visit the spot. And what's the other theory? That they used poison gas into Patton's room. I've been to the room where he died, and there was a nurse on duty with him 24-7. There's actually a chart with all the nurses' names and their hours. You know, so it's kind of easy to punch holes in those theories. And I think it's a lot like with JFK, where this is a pretty amazing person, and that there's no way they could just be befallen.
Well, he was larger than life, and probably folks felt he doesn't die, he just keeps going.
Yeah,
and
it's like, not fair for him to die in a car accident, because that can't possibly be.
Yes, and now when he succumbed to pneumonia because he was in a body cast, correct?
No, it was actually a brain aneurysm that finally killed him, and that's normal in a lot of cases of people being paralyzed.
Oh, I didn't. I was thinking more along the line of pneumonia because he couldn't clear his lungs having a body cast. He had a full body cast.
That's right. Well, they had actually put him in the full body cast because they were talking about moving him back to the United States. Huh. He did spend most of the time outside the body cast, but he did have trouble raising, I guess the technical word was sputum, is what it's in all the medical records about Patton, that he had trouble clearing that, which is normal with being paralyzed because not your body's not working the way it's supposed to.
He was a man for all ages.
He truly was.
And he, I just can't, well, I'll let you talk about the superlatives. We got about 2 minutes. Go ahead and give us your epithet on General George S. Patton. Go ahead.
Well, I would say that General George S. Patton was a man who lived his vocation every day. He loved what he was doing. He had a passion for it, and he wanted to do it right, and he knew how serious and important what he was doing was. He kept diaries. He took pictures. He kept a perfect record for any historian following his path, and really was one of the important figures that made this country the great country it is today. Because if we didn't have great generals in World War II, we would not be the world power we are today.
What was his birth sign?
His birth sign? He was born November 11th.
Oh, he's a Scorpio.
On, Veterans Day. How about that?
And I was November 13th. Ho, ho,
hey,
ho. Yeah.
So you tell me what sign he was.
Okay. November 11th. I'll have to remember that. That's right. That's Armistice Day. We've got... anything else you want to, you got a new book coming out. Let's very quickly talk about that. We've got about 1 minute. Tell us about your research that you're doing.
Well, I'm working on a book on General Patton called Patton's War, and it's just focusing on him during World War II. It's not being published for a little while. It's a lot of research, but I'm loving every second of it. I've got him all the way into England right now, and I spend most of my time at the archive, you know, digging through documents, looking for new information and relying on some old. And when it comes out, I think it'll be another layer of the Patton story.
Kevin Hemel, please, and I know you will, come on back one more time maybe before Armistice Day, and we'll talk some more about World War II. So thank you, Kevin.
I'd love to, Bob.
And until next week, folks, this is Bob and Dale and Nina from Veterans Radio. You're dismissed.